Welcome to the call today. This is the virtual caucus call for the Future Left. My name is Carter Phipps. Welcome, everyone. I'm joined today by my the co-founder of the Institute of Cultural Evolution, Steve McIntosh. Steve, welcome.
Thank you, Carter.
So we'll be your host today as we explore the Future Left. And just to say a few words about how the call is going to go, and then we'll bring our panelists in as well. The Institute for Cultural Evolution, just to give you some background on that, is a nonprofit think tank organized around the goal of applying groundbreaking insights from integral philosophy, developmental psychology, evolutionary theory, and the social sciences to help create significant forward movement in the evolution of America's cultural and political landscape. In a sense, we're focusing on the cultural roots of America's political challenges, in a sense. So that's our goal. And so we're having this call to really explore what the future left would look like that would overcome some of the tremendous polarization that exists today in American politics. Political polarization has really been a focus of the Institute for Cultural Evolution. So what would a future left look like that wasn't as highly polarized? And what would a future right look like that wasn't as highly polarized? Now, we won't be talking about the right today. The right is for another call. That's the future right call, which is still in development, and we'll give you information as we develop that caucus call. Today, we're going to be talking about the future left. So I'm going to bring in our two panelists right now and just introduce them briefly. So the first is a close colleague and friend, both Steve and I's, Elizabeth DeBold. Elizabeth, welcome to the call.
Thank you.
So Elizabeth is one of the world's foremost authorities on girls and women's development. She studied with Carol Gilligan at Harvard and has a PhD. She has a best-selling book called The Mother-Daughter Revolution. And for the past three decades, she has worked on the front lines of gender and cultural evolution as an activist, researcher, journalist, spiritual explorer, and transformative educator. Elizabeth and I, as some of you may know, worked together for a number of years. So she's a close friend, but also a longtime colleague. We worked together on EnlightenX magazine as editors on that magazine. And she has a long-time passion and interest for activism and really focusing on some of the transformational agenda and political agenda that the left has cared about for the last 30 or 40 years. She's been in the front lines of that in different ways over the last 40 years. So we're thrilled to have her on the call. And she's also a principal and a co-founder of the Institute for Cultural Evolution. So welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you very much, Carter. Glad to be here.
Great. All right. And our other panel member is Terry Patton. Terry is also a friend and of Steve and I's and a colleague and on the advisory board of the Institute for Cultural Evolution, and he is a leading voice in the emerging field of integral evolutionary leadership. He is a member of the Evolutionary Leaders Group. He's a member of the editorial board of the journal Integral Theory and Practice. And he serves on the board of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. And he holds degrees from the University of Michigan and from John F. Kennedy University. He has a book that he co-authored with Ken Wilber called Integral Life Practice, a 21st Century Blueprint for Physical Health, Emotional Balance, Mental Clarity, and Spiritual Awakening. And what people may not know as well about Terry is he has also been a longtime political activist from his days as a student activist at the University of Michigan in the 60s. A few years ago, he was on a citizen diplomacy mission to Iran. He has played a role in the Obama campaign in trying to bring new ideas and fresh thinking to the Obama campaign. And he has developed his own movement within the integral philosophical community called Occupy Integral about how to bring political activism to that community and really develop, in a sense, do exactly what we're trying to speak to in this call, which is develop the left to be a more powerful voice in American politics. So welcome, Terry. Great to have you on the call.
Thanks so much, Carter. I'm excited to be here.
All right, good. So what we're going to do is Steve and I are going to speak briefly about the campaign for the depolarization campaign that we've been developing and how it relates to the future left. And then we're going to bring in our panelists, and they're going to speak for about half an hour, and we're going to then have a bit of a dialogue and ask questions. And then we want to get, since this is a caucus call, we really want to get people some participation from questioners, and we want to get some participation from the audience. And so we'll give you a chance to vote on some issues and that you care about, you know, some of the issues that you feel the left should care about. We'll take your temperature on those issues, and then we'll have an opportunity later in the call where you can also we can break out. Since this is a Maestro call, some people are in the Maestro technology, you can focus on breakout groups, and we'll have a chance to talk amongst yourselves. Not everyone can do that. This call is also being webcast, but at least some will be able to do that. So we'll have a chance for a participatory element in the call later on. All right, so just a brief words about before I turn it over to Steve. So this call is part of a larger campaign to what we're calling to depolarize the American mind. And the Institute for Cultural Evolution has produced a long white paper outlining the details of the campaign and the philosophical context of that campaign called by the same name, Depolarizing the American Mind. We are hosting conferences. We're hosting these virtual caucus calls on the future left and future right. This is also part of a crowdfunding campaign that we'll tell you more about later in the call. We just recently returned from a conference at Esalen Institute, where we hosted some of the top thinkers in the country from some of the top political think tanks in Washington, actually, where we discussed these issues of political polarization, why our culture is so highly polarized, what we can do about it. So fascinating discussions there and fascinating individuals. And our approach and our paper was actually very well received there. So we're excited. We feel like we're gaining some traction with thinking about political polarization in the way we are today. And to tell you more about that, I want to turn it over to Steve now, who's going to give you some context for what we mean when we talk about depolarizing the American mind through thinking about the future left and the future right. In this case, the future left. All right, Steve. Steve, are you there? Okay. Well, so our first. Okay, there he is. All right, Steve.
Yeah. I'm cutting in and out here, but I'll do my best to say some things. So first of all, the ideas behind this idea of the future left and the future right are explained and developed in our white paper, as Carter mentioned, Depolarizing the American Mind. And in order to give those ideas a full treatment, it would take up too much of our time. So I invite readers, we have an abridged version of that to check out. We also get across many of the ideas or the philosophy behind what we're trying to do in our campaign in our polarization test, which shows people, based on their values ranking, where they fall along the political spectrum, or at least tries to give some additional resolution to that, and then suggests exercises for how people can broaden their thinking. Right? We're not trying to get people to adopt a centrist position. What we're trying to do is broaden the scope of what people are able to value, and that can create evolution across the board, not just in politics. But it's important to say up front that from our perspective, the whole idea of left and right is somewhat outdated and confusing. In other words, prior to the emergence of the new countercultural postmodern worldview that first began to emerge and become a politically significant, the left and the right did adequately describe mainstream politics in America. But now that simple horizontal conception of left and right no longer adequately describes what the current spectrum looks like. And so in our paper, we outline trying to keep it simple, trying to work within the cultural agreement structures that we find ourselves in. In other words, the media still largely thinks in terms of left and right. So we're starting there even while acknowledging, you know, the limitations of that conception. we try to fill that out a bit by talking about two kinds of left and two kinds of right. The two kinds of right are the socially conservative right, the traditionalists, and then the fiscally conservative right, who are more modernist but still right of center. The two kinds of left are standard liberal modernists who still, you know, dominate the Democratic Party, but then what we call progressive postmodernists, and these are people who are more countercultural and who question modernity and the establishment more thoroughly and sometimes often harshly. So this, we're acknowledging that the complexity is much greater than left and right, but you know, we've got to start somewhere, and so this is a convenient way to begin to engage the ideas. In our paper, we describe what we consider the future left to a degree and outline some of the positions that we see the future left taking in this expanded value conception, but we're not trying to advance a kind of a manifesto of what the new left is, because we want this to be a collaborative effort. We want it to be politically potent, which means that it's got to garner agreement. So garnering agreement involves carefully listening to the community, debating these ideas in public, which led to the idea of a Maestro call, where we can begin to do that. And we can invite each of you, even, you know, during and after the call, to continue to give us your ideas, you know, positive or negative about what we're doing, and you can contact us at info@culturalevolution.org. We'll repeat that email address towards the end, but info@culturalevolution.org is the way
and
to get with us directly.
Steve, I'll just break in there for a moment and just say there's three ways you can communicate with us on this call. That's the primary one, info@culturalevolution.org. You can email us, ask us any questions either during this call or after. You can write something on Twitter, a question on Twitter, communicate about this call on Twitter. Just use #futureleft, and we will see that. Or on your webcast, for those who are listening on webcast, there's a box there where you can put in questions and or comments, and we will see those as well. All right.
Right. Well, I'll just make one more point, and then we'll turn it over to our panelists. While this idea of left and right is outdated and potentially too simplistic to define the politics that we find ourselves in now, one of the things that we talk about in our paper is how polarities, natural polarities, those that are concerned about the rights of the individual, for example, and those who are concerned about the needs of the community, there's many ways that this existential polarity of left and right manifests, and it not only manifests across the levels, it also manifests within the left, right? We can see the same polarity of liberal and conservative on the left side of the spectrum, and that's something we describe to a degree in our paper. But I think for the four of us, and for many on the call, are familiar with integral philosophy and integral parlance, and many are not, and we certainly don't expect the people understand, you know, the jargon of integral. But one of the ways that we see things evolving is that this polarity of left and right in the future will eventually manifest in a way that's more evolved than it exists now. And one of the ways that the left and the right can both evolve, we argue, is by integrating some of the wisdom of the other side. And the analogy that we use is we can see how our ideals, our social ideals of masculine and feminine have evolved over the past 40 or 50 years, from where being, you know, masculine meant being macho and feminine meant being demure. And now we, you know, our ideals of femininity and masculinity are much more evolved. Being feminine can also include being very strong and independent. Being masculine can include being sensitive and emotional while still being manly or still being, you know, thoroughly feminine. So these are ways that our gender ideals have evolved to a degree that incorporates some of the other side and makes them less polarized. And we can see that the left and the right, that this is an open direction of evolution wherein both sides can understand something of the other side that could be profitably incorporated into the value system while still retaining, you know, the core orientations and values that animate that side from the beginning. So we're advocating for, obviously, some kind of an integral evolution, but at the same time we want to focus on what's possible, what Stuart Kaufman calls the adjacent possible in evolution, what's possible to move next. So We're recognizing this postmodern worldview, this countercultural progressive worldview, one of the ways that it can evolve while still being adjacently possible to where it is now is to move from to a position of more optimism, a position of more hope for our future. And that's something we can talk about and question and debate in the call. But that gives a bit of background of our thinking behind this evolution of left and right and where it might be going. But we're also very interested to hear from our panelists and the people on the call about where they think evolution is heading in this area. And so that's a quick frame of where we're coming from.
Okay, great. There's much to unpack there, and we'll come back to some of that. Thanks, Steve. But I think this is a good moment to hear from Elizabeth and Terry and to kind of to let them kind of take the ball and run with it. You know, this essential question, what would a future left look like that had begun to better integrate, as you say, some of the, you know, how do you integrate some of the wisdom of your opponent in some sense, but while maintaining very much the core identity of being left and of being on that side of the polarity, not just meeting in the middle, but actually really moving forward in a way that, you know, it was interesting in the green room right before the call, the four of us were talking a little bit, and there was a general feeling that the left largely has lost a lot of its potency right now in American politics. And the message is not, you know, the message of the left is not as coherent as it seemed to be at one point. And so I think Terry and Elizabeth are both going to have a lot more to say about that. So I'll turn it over to Elizabeth now, and then Terry can speak after that. And so Elizabeth, take it away. We have a bit of a delay here. Elizabeth, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. No problem.
Great. Thank you, Carter, and thanks, Steve, for the introduction. And Steve, you brought up a lot of things that we could probably spend all afternoon unpacking. I'd like to, as you were saying, we were talking in the green room before, and I think that there are real questions that right now for that the left has to really look at and deal with. The value set that is left has become much less clear in the last probably 15 to 20 years, and it looks like it's going to continue in that vein. The left in America has always been different than the left has been in Europe, for example. I'm calling in today from Germany. I'm spending a lot of my time here these days, and the left in Europe tends to be have come out of Marxism, come out of the workers' solidarity movement, and that hasn't been a ground in the United States. The United States, in many ways, the kind of left discussion has been about how do we give every American the opportunity to develop the capacities and the income to be able to share in the good life that is the American way of life. And if you find, and many lefties find those terms, the American way of life and so forth, to be a bit like, wait a minute, what are we talking about here? But I'm putting those in brackets or in quotes. For example, the Great Society programs under Johnson, the moves from the 60s around racial equality, women's equality, the gay rights movement, were all movements about we all want to be able to participate and not be disenfranchised from the core, what America has to offer. And I think that has been what the left has spent an enormous amount of time engaging with in the last few decades. And it's ironic, but at this point, if you think about the sort of move for gay marriage came out of the right, rather than out of the left. It was carried and run with by the left. But the gay marriage movement was considered to be too much to ask for from the left. And when it came from the right, it gave the left an opportunity to push this, you know, push gay marriage. So there's the kind of belief in individual liberty and the rights of the individual to be able to live their lives, to love who they want to love, to do what they want to do, which had been the foundation of identity politics coming out of the 60s, is now something that is going mainstream. It's now something that is no longer simply identified with the left. So then what is left of the left? When questions of the equality, justice, and so forth now become much more nuanced, much more complex in how we think about them, how do we move from where we are now when so many laws are on the books that dictate equality or that give the opportunity for equality? How do we move forward? And it's a very big question. So at this point, I think if you look at the Occupy movement, and I think Terry, you probably have a lot more to say about that up close and personal than I do. But the values that the left has in some ways represent how do we move forward and create a new culture? How do we create a culture that is as I was saying, that allows individuals or allows people to live healthy, meaningful lives? The right tends to be conservative, meaning to conserve, to say, well, we've got a system, it's good enough, it's really good, and we want to keep it the way it is. The left is always saying, no, we want to include more. There's more of a concern on the left with community, with the commons, with how do we create a society as a whole? How do we make the system as it is work for the benefit of the whole? Again, that's sort of great society and moving forward from that. Now, what's happened as the laws that were fought for in the 60s and 70s and even recently are on the books is that the left is now left without a real push and without a real agenda, except for one that is anti what the right is doing. So we end up getting a very polarized, and particularly for I think for a lot of young people, a kind of I don't even want to be part of the political system anymore. I'm against the kind of corporate capitalism that seems to be behind the government. I'm against these. The moves that have been made in, that are I'm against the kind of capitalism and how it actually is dictating our lives. So there's a real push against and a pushback against what exists as the dominant system in America, rather than an articulation of something that we're standing for. And I think that's one of the main problems right now on the left is that it's become an anti, particularly the very progressive left, the postmodern left, that emerged out of the 60s and now is taking, as I've been tracking, is taking different forms. But it's this sense of being against, being victimized by, being there's an articulation of very deep concerns about how human beings are being treated by the system, by within a context of white supremacy, within a context that is still patriarchal. There are very much these concerns, and yet it's a concern that expresses itself as a negation. We don't want that anymore. But what it is that is being asked for and what the vision is as we're moving into the future and making arguments for change has not been articulated. And so I feel that right now the left's job is to is to really get in there and say, this is, instead of just being against, we want to engage optimistically with where we can go. And I think that that's one of the things you said, what can the left take from the right? I think that often we think about the sense of optimism that comes with progress and as something that is inherently modernist or capitalist, and we need to create a new kind of optimism. But for that optimism, we have to create a vision for what that would be about. What is the new economic system? Is it basic income, as Switzerland and other countries are beginning to discuss? Is it a modified version of capitalism? What are we talking about? And I think as that is something that I think is beginning to be discussed on the left, and I see that as a move that will depolarize some of the kind of almost reflexive antithesis that you feel from postmodern progressives. So I could say a lot more, but I think I'll wrap it there.
Well, thanks, Elizabeth. I'm more, I was actually raised in an intentional community by a bunch of old lefties, pacifists and union organizers and civil rights leaders. And there's a certain passion for justice that was really at the core of the left, a care about the people who are marginalized or left out, whether they be women at one point or blacks or gay people. The soul of the left is a kind of heart of care for that which is getting short shrift. Yeah, the system works for some people, but not for everybody. And now we're even extending our circle of care to include the animals in factory farms, the habitats and creatures in environments that are under threat. We're recognizing that our atmosphere is one of the negative externalities that's been a victim of the pattern of things, and we're caring about all those things. And that's, I think, the soul of what the left has always been about. Now, this care for what's getting short shrift is facing a whole new set of facts on the ground, in that the best democracy on the planet, the oldest and original democracy, the world's one superpower, has gradually had its mechanisms exploited, so that the oligarchy and plutocracy and kleptocracy of power has distorted it to the point that we have actual political gridlock and incredible widening inequality. And a lot of the values that were effectively served by our political and social institutions are not being served at all. Not only that, we're really getting to a place where a lot of folks, for very real reasons, are hitting the panic button about the global warming issue. It's an overarching issue, like Naomi Klein, a big voice in the current left, says this changes everything. And all of these things are issues that are of at issue for the left in a whole new way. So among people that I'm engaged with, I see a breakdown along the lines of, are we so disaffected from the system altogether that we're simply trying to do something at the margins, like the Occupy movement or alternative currencies or things that have nothing to do with political engagement? Or do we do some of those things and also try to elect the candidates that are going to create balances to some of the ridiculous positions right now that we have with the Republican Party? Because clearly any intelligent participation on the left today has got to be a little bit aghast at a political party that tends to have a base that doesn't believe in evolution, doesn't believe in global warming, doesn't really care about even a semblance of democracy in terms of voting rights. But I think the new left has to become something entirely different from what it's been before. Instead of being an alliance between relatively uneducated, marginalized populations like minorities and very sophisticated intelligentsias on the coasts, the New Left is going to have to become a something with a spiritual heart and soul. The habit of the left is to speak truth to power, to always stand in the position, like you were pointing out, Elizabeth, of being against the status quo. Whereas there's going to have to be a spiritual maturity that's going to have to be grown into by large numbers of us, in which a left arises that isn't defining itself by its impotence and its marginalization, but instead that has both a heart of care and an inspiration that is positive, that allows it to actually stand in a different relationship to power, capable of holding power, capable of growing into a different relationship to things. While we're seeing all these different crises in the planet create new windows of opportunity for more fundamental systems redesign, people of good faith who care about those values that have been given short shrift by the way the system is operated can come together in as a political force that opens to, I think, a source of spiritual inspiration, a recognition that there's an inherent self-correcting, self-rightening intelligence in being itself, and a sense of inspiration, I think a transrational, spiritual inspiration that draws us to make a difference in the affairs of man here on the planet, in just the sense that of stewardship for the planet. You know, we, in our care for everything, lit by our spiritual intuition of our relationship to goodness and truth and beauty and love and joy and freedom and our care for everything that lives or ever has lived or ever can live, our championship of the great 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 grandchildren of people we don't know yet, our realization that we have spiritual connections to all that, that can bring us together with a kind of inspiration that can hold power instead of speaking truth to power. The angry, marginalized, hand-wringing relationship to those injustices can be replaced by a more heroic and affirmative relationship, where instead of always looking to regulate and bog down the vitality of the free enterprise system, we can be much more interested in using market mechanisms and the kind of enlightened paternalism of making the default positions of our laws and regulations one that work to the benefit of people instead of exploiting them. An undermining of the way the oligarchic, plutocratic, kleptocratic class. And those are inherent forces in being. It's not like anybody's evil. It just tends to be that powerful forces tend to become dominant and work their will on things in ways that undermine the patterns in it. I think that the new left is a more enlightened, less angry, less and just the way that you said, Elizabeth, less angry, but what replaces the anger, I think, is spiritual inspiration and a kind of love that it's not just positive rather than negative. It's actually lit up. And I think that the crises that are upon us are going to create windows of opportunity for much more fundamental systems redesign. And it's looking toward how that will express itself that is what inspires me for my future career as an activist.
Fantastic. Thank you both. I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to kind of pick up on that, ask a question. Steve, jump in as need be. I mean, and this is for both of you as you speak about that. I mean, obviously there's some common themes in what you brought up there. But let me kind of get at an issue that's been I've been thinking about since we had this conference a couple weeks ago and we were really discussing these issues. And some things came out about the left that were really on my mind. One is that as you spoke to, Tara, you know, there's a kind of, you know, sort of heartfelt, beautiful idealism on the left that inspired me, has always inspired me, growing up, was part of my upbringing in some way, as it sounds like it was part of you, a kind of idealism that all should be included for fairness, for a certain kind of care for the community, care for other beings. There's a kind of idealism that's, you know, about what society could be on the left. The danger, and I think I always related to that as this wholesome, positive thing. Well, I think I also began to realize as I mature and as I get older that to the extent that that idealism sort of gets disconnected from the pragmatic realities of society sort of struggling forward and trying to find its way and trying to improve and trying to move forward and trying to do the right things and trying to be politically real, to the extent that idealism gets disconnected, you know, become from reality, you know, in some sense, and from the realities of on the ground of the world we're in, of the system we're in, of the economic realities of all of that, the political realities, It can become sort of been disconnected, and I think some of that antithesis, that anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-whatever it looks like, that anti-position, it easily is born out of that. Let me just give just two examples of this, and I'm hoping maybe you all could respond to it. You know, people often say we're in the beginning, or at least well into the second Gilded Age, you know, where income inequality is rising. The first Gilded Age was in the late 19th century, and where income inequality was rising, and we did a number of things in the early 20th century to deal with that. We introduced the income tax, we changed the economic structures a bit, we changed our governmental structures. We did a number of things to deal with that first Gilded Age. Some of the Marxist movements came out of that original Gilded Age of an industrializing society. They were very ideal. Some of those are socialistic movements and Marxist movements, as Elizabeth spoke about, were very idealistic and about what could be accomplished, changing the system completely. And yet where those took hold the strongest, the economic systems ended up being the most destructive and the most – people end up being the least well off, those idealistic potentials almost kind of capture the imagination the strongest. Where they got maybe even more disconnected from the realities of the economic system we were in. And let me give another example of that. We were just at the Esalen conference. It was co-sponsored with a think tank in my hometown of Oakland called the Breakthrough Institute, and they're an environmental think tank. And one of the issues, and they really are working on, what's the way you deal practically with climate change? How do you deal with our energy needs of our society, of our global society? And, you know, and they talk a lot about it, and they find what they come up against over and over again is the kind of the idealism that's divorced from the actual pragmatic realities of our global energy needs that exist in many of the major environmental organizations around the country. That's their main obstacle to being able to deal with a lot of the situations, environmental situations and energy situations we need to deal with. It's that kind of false idealism, that kind of idealism that's disconnected. So I wanted to put that to you, to both of you, because on one hand it's the part of the left that is beautiful and I love, and it sort of has been infused in me since I was young, and yet it's also the part I realize that can be terribly misleading and can lead us to be disconnected into this kind of antithesis position. You say we're always speaking truth to power, we're not dealing with power, holding on to power, and moving the society forward in the way the left should have a vision for.
I think what you're speaking to, Carter, is I think the real nub of where the left needs to go, because I also wanted to pick up on what Terry was saying about care, and you know that we need something on the left that is a higher moral context, and there has been one, and it has been justice. And as Terry said, and it is about giving everyone an equal shake, trying to create a level playing field, trying to make sure that people aren't wronged by the system. And with the laws on the books, it hasn't happened. and it hasn't happened for a lot of other reasons that have taken, you know, kind of had momentum in the last half century, I guess. But I think it is this lack of getting your hands dirty and proposing something, and saying or the lack of caucusing on the left around, well, what is it? What are we proposing? How do we move forward? And a kind of holding on to, and I'm going to put it starkly, holding on to a victimized identity, and holding on to these, a belief that I don't have power, and I don't have power, they do, or the system does, and it's too big for all of us, ends up, while you can for a period of time, I think, negotiate one's idealism and have that as a real move and momentum, at a certain point it can lead to incredible cynicism and a real dropout from the political system entirely and a giving up on the whole thing, because it's like, here's my idealism, this is what I believe in, and it's too complex, I'm way outgunned, so I'm a victim of this, and therefore I'm out of it. And I think that the left has been too identified with victimization rather than seeing, sort of reflecting to themselves, you know, ourselves, this is who we are. We are the people who care about a certain kind of justice and feel that we want to create a world in which the income inequality is less. And this is how we see this could happen. Right now, I think there's a real dearth of creative. I think it's just beginning, frankly. I have a close colleague who does a lot of consulting to progressive activist organizations, and she was asked to convene forums, in-house forums for some of the top leftist think tanks and activist groups about what are new models of the economy that we could focus on. But this is where a new optimism can come from, where that care that Terry was speaking about, that could be the moral underpinning that is both spiritual and even people who and there are many on the left who because of the excesses of religion are and the Tea Party and so forth are really anti-spiritual, but they care. And so I think care can be a real lever for a kind of coherence of moral and spiritual renewal of the left, or reclaiming of the left. But it has to be in relationship to things that are, that are real, like about the economy. How does it work? What do we do?
Elizabeth,
go ahead.
When you point out the importance of departing from a victim psychology, I'm really with you. And when you're emphasizing the importance of care, I'm with you there too. And I think then you're making a third key point here, that it has to connect to actual policy, actual achievable goals, and that perhaps the way that Occupy and other new left movements have operated has been less connected to actual policy implementation. Is that where you're headed here?
Well, I think that the left's job is to envision a new world in some ways. We're asking people to kind of move forward into something new. What is that? What is that world that allows people to be fully who they are, have meaningful and productive lives in community, in relationship with other human beings? And we haven't articulated that yet.
Well, in a way, the crises that are upon us mean that time is on our side. You know, the Republican Party is in the process of completely discrediting itself with not just with voting blocks like Hispanics, but with everybody over issues like global warming. So there's going to be a political vacuum that's going to be created. The problem is that the genuine heart and core of of that with which we would create the future is hardly represented by what we see in the Democratic Party. You know, the only thing I like less than the Democrats are the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So my sense is that the core of this is yes, about envisioning the world we want to see come into being, but envisioning that in a way that's in context, in a context in which, you know, particularly the destabilization of our climate is pretty significant, and we can go into that in a way that isn't merely negative, isn't merely victimized. You know, it's inspiring to be alive at a time in which these crises are hitting. It is a leverage for opportunity, for things to be rewritten. It creates a window of opportunity for a new world to come into being. That's exciting and that's inspiring for people of vision who look at the imbalances and the disenfranchised and marginalized humans and creatures as you know, fellow participants in remaking a world that can be genuinely healthier and can create opportunities for everyone to thrive together in a different way of relating to one another. I mean, I think the core of what the new left can be is this higher we that we talk about a lot in our spiritual conversations, that there's a different way of being related to one another and therefore a different fabric of connectedness. And I think the heart of the new left may be a coming together of people such that we have a different kind of fellowship that absolutely can't be this kind of wrung out, resentful, and you know, the two things I don't like about the old left are not just the victimization, but this kind of tone of piety. You know, all the peace activists and civil rights activists and the economic opportunity activists who were my aunts and uncles and who bred me, they were wonderful people in most ways, but they were content to simply be holier than thou, to rest themselves in, well, I'm doing the best good thing that can be done, even if it's not prevailing. And this contentment with being more pious and better, you know, morally than others, forget it. That the new left cannot indulge in that any more than it can indulge in this victimization mood.
Well, along those lines, let me just throw in a question here for the two of you. When we see the media, the way the national media portrays national politics, and you see characters like Ted Cruz getting credibility, and people on the left have to groan because you think, you know, how could people who have those opinions be taken so seriously? And so much of the focus of the left is lamenting how we can get the right to evolve. You know, why are the right so backwards? How can they think that way? But one of the premises behind our campaign at the Institute for Cultural Evolution is that if the left evolves first, if the progressive party who cares is more invested in progress, if they move first, in some ways that will create a clearing or an opening for evolution to occur on the right. Now, that's a complicated subject, but just to bring it home, the idea that so much of the at least the progressive side of the left is disconnected from what's politically possible is exemplified in some ways by the popularity of Charles Eisenstein, right, who's gotten a lot of attention on the left for his utopian visions of a more sort of loving economy, and it's hard to argue with the idealistic vision. The trouble is that the rest of the country, modernism and traditionalism, have a hard time relating to that. So it's easy to sort of circle the wagons within your little progressive community, but connecting that to the larger society in a way that can persuade them and describe a future vision that includes them and not just people who are already postmodern, I think that's the challenge. Maybe you could say a little bit about that.
Well, in a sense, you're offering two critiques. One is the left needs to move first, bemoaning the problems of the right are not the point. And the other is maybe the left needs not to be so insular and just circling its wagons within its own disconnected group, but speak more to the needs of the greater body politic. And I'm kind of more along the lines of feeling that the roots of the New Left really are spiritual. That's why so much of my work is in that domain. I think that actual practitioners and a culture of practice and a higher quality of intersubjectivity and a capacity to actually trust one another, to have each other's back, to be for each other in at a deeper level, begins to create something cohesive among us. And I think that the New Left is, by its nature, less polarized. You know, one of the things that happens for me is I'm less unfriendly to things that I used to abhor, the seemingly covert racism on the right, for instance. I'm now beginning to become a little bit more appreciative of the fact that people need to be able to affirmatively connect to their own local groups, the people, you know, the, quote, people like me, unquote. And that appreciation. I think that our willingness to tar everybody with, you know, racist or nationalist brushes and just kind of make them wrong and bad is one of the worst habits on the left that need to be outgrown. I think that the kind of indignation, the sense that people like me are losing out, you know, that kind of resentment that's taking place among many white Americans because they're becoming a minority now in my own country, after all, you know, that these are understandable concerns. And so ceasing to just distance from them and make them wrong, that's a piece, that's something I can do. But I think that the most creative work I can do is among people who are thought leaders of, who are more similar to me, to actually create something more coherent and yeasty here with us.
Yeah, thanks. That's exactly what we're trying to do.
I think that those that what in that coherence, I think very real steps need to be taken that are, you know, that are about policies, about, you know, Otto Scharmer's written a book, or, you know, Jeremy Rifkin has written a book, both coming basically from the left, also with a spiritual view. Saying, you know, trying to talk about how do we steer this, you know, how do we actually bring about change in the systems that we're part of, and you know that I think it's funny, it's interesting, Terry, that you know I recognize, I mean, I think that my sense of or my spirituality in some ways began with that. With the leftist care, but I also recognize that a lot of leftists are very, very allergic to anything, you know, remotely spiritual. So I mean, it's an interesting thing. That's why I think care is actually such a powerful way to create solidarity and kind of connectivity between amongst leftists, but again, I think that the places that the left needs to go are about getting more concrete rather than staying in an idealistic and ideal realm.
I think I'm just gonna add a brief point here, and then I think we'll take a couple questions. But I just, we're sort of circling around a few of these different issues that you just spoke to, Elizabeth, which are really important. And I think this issue that you spoke to as well, Terry, in terms of the, you know, this is true on both sides. It's certainly true of the right as well, that tendency to sort of dismiss your opponents, dismiss those on the other side of the political fence so quickly as being ill-motivated, as being sort of just, not just wrong-headed, but wrongly motivated, but, you know, a dark person, a tainted soul, sort of, you know. And that's what feeds the hyper-polarized climate. And it certainly is true on the right. But we're not talking about the right now. We're talking about the left. And you see that on the left too much, I think. And I think it's not just that we shouldn't do it. I think it's actually inaccurate a lot of times, in the sense that I hear people, as you say, refer to, you know, the hatred or the against Obama as racist. Well, you know, I'm sure it can be, but I think we're too quick to paint, to tar that brush. There are, at the core of some of the reactions and responses, are real values being expressed. Now, maybe they're being expressed in a wrong-headed or unfortunate way. Maybe they're being, but those are legitimate concerns, legitimate values, legitimate issues that those people are often concerned about. Maybe they're expressing them in ways that we really disagree with. But I think one of the things we can do to overcome polarization, at least, is to begin to give our opponents a little more credit for at least having, you know, good intentions within their own context, even if we disagree with how they're expressing. So,
one thing there, Carter,
it's interesting.
Sure. I think that there's a funny performative contradiction, I think, in the left, because there is this foundation of care and justice and you know, in some ways you could even say the sacredness of all human beings, all animal life, whatever, the earth, and you know, whether it's the value of all, and yet one's opponents are less than human, you know, often, or seen as some kind of variant life form. And I think that there's something ironic about that when the, sort of the foundation is about this kind of shared humanity, if you will.
And so much of the beautiful breakthroughs of the left were born in taking stands that were righteous and were reacting to some extraordinarily important dehumanizing truths about society. But sometimes, but that doesn't mean that every issue is like that, or that every situation, you know, it's like you can kind of default to that as being sort of in painting so many issues like that and so many people in that with that context. And I think the more we cannot do that, the more. And part of it comes from, again, integrating, appreciating, understanding some of the values of your opponent. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them. It doesn't mean you can't, you know, voraciously disagree with people. But one way to overcome the polarization is to begin to, allow disagreement. But there's a certain level of demonization that we are definitely caught up in right now in our political climate that just you can't move forward. And I think we're going to talk about the right, and obviously there's a lot of blame to go around, but we have to be the change. In this call, I guess, is the left, like as a progressive like to say. All right, I think what we'll do is we're going to step back for a moment and take a couple questions here before we move on to the next section of our call. So again, you can email us questions at info@culturalevolution.org. You can tweet us questions at #FutureLeft. And you can ask questions directly on Maestro by clicking on the one button. I see someone has already pressed the one button. So you can click on the one button on Maestro and let's see if we have a question or a response to our dialogue here. Okay. Someone from area code 404, if we can unmute that person. And, all right, you should be unmuted. Is there a question?
Hey, good afternoon. I appreciate this talk and your time and all the work you guys have collectively done. We see such apathy, I think, in the way that people vote. I mean, I live in a fairly affluent area. For local election, 10-15% people voting. So, sure, great to look at big picture, sort of Obama, the polarization at that level, but we set up. But I think we can be more involved in our sports, in our local politics, started at that level, and don't worry so much, perhaps at the big level, so we don't have as much traction individually.
Okay, thank you, sir. You were breaking up a little bit, but if I'm understanding what you were saying, you were talking about, you know, the necessity of, you talked initially about voting, and then you talked about being involved at the local level, maybe not worrying about the big national ideas or international ideas, but, you know, being an activist and engaging at the local level of politics. Is that correct?
Yeah, because in other words, because it's easy to read about someone on the other side, but it's one thing to know your neighbor, who may be a libertarian, who may be a Republican, local level, in my opinion.
Okay, great. I'm going to put that out to the panel there. Anyone want to take that one on?
Well, I would just agree that dialogue between between real living people is, I think, going to be essential at in many ways of rebuilding the fabric of our country. And you know, the leftist desire for community, for creating, you know, creating a whole society, you know, it doesn't just exist at the national level. The government isn't going to do it, and I think that's one of the shifts for the left. And so really engaging in locally is very important. I agree.
I could add that one of the ways that that can happen, I mean, there are trends, a lot of trends that whereas people who are on the left tend to move to communities that are left communities, and likewise the right, there seems to be a trend in America where the tribes are consolidating by location, and so that makes it more difficult to find people on the other side who are your neighbors across the fence that you can dialogue with. So one of the things that we have in our polarization test, which includes a lot of exercises for people to consider, both just questions and more thorough writing and activism exercises, one of those exercises is to find somebody, if you're on the left, find somebody who's more to the left of you and start by talking to them. In other words, we can encourage dialogue between left and right by encouraging a reduction in polarization and a recognition of good faith across the spectrum, and that can start by talking to people who often have a hard time seeing that. You know, in other words, convincing the more radical elements of both left and right to recognize the humanity in all of us. That's another important part of the dialogue that's called for.
That's interesting. You know, it operates both positively and negatively, I'm afraid. I think that one of the reasons that we tend to resist political engagement at a local level is that it means going to these interminable community meetings, town meetings, and city council meetings with people we don't really enjoy listening to, and under circumstances that bring about our alienation. Like we tend to notice the frustrating limitations of the people when we're, you know, getting down into the guts of things with them, cheek to jowl. And some of the people that I think are the greatest heroes on the left are the people who have been able to dig into those levels of engagement in productive ways. And some of the things with dynamic facilitation and other kinds of conflict resolution that have actually been able to create common ground in local issues that have become really polarized. That's a real place of heroism that I'm not expert in, but that I'm inspired by.
Mm-hmm. All right, we have a question online from Plano, Texas. Someone's asking, most of the conversation is focused on reforming the current systems and structures. What about an alternative view and establishing entirely new systems and structures? And I think this is a, you know, because the left has tended to be, this is a question I think is a lot of people may have, because the left has tended to be more progressive and trying to move society forward, envisioning new structures, envisioning new ways that society needs to move and change and transform and progress in the ways it wants to. So this is a question that comes up a lot, and would anyone like to respond to that?
Well, I think that's actually really important, that in a way we are probably – I'm both more optimistic and pessimistic than most people I find myself talking with. I think there are going to be structural breakdowns in our current system that are going to create windows of opportunity for much more fundamental changes. And I think that people who are prototyping radical alternatives are creating the spare parts out of which we can assemble the reforms that are going to be really necessary. One of the ways that I look at things is that you know, back in November of 2008, Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson could have nationalized the banks in America. You know, really radical change was possible because the liquidity crisis was creating unthinkable, you know, potential consequences that could have justified changes that otherwise never could have been justified. And with global warming hitting the kinds of places that it is, the culture wars breaking down, the issues with environment, loose nukes, breakdown in financial systems, there are going to be opportunities for more radical changes. So people who are working on more radical alternatives may discover that there are going to be ways that they have actually built the spare parts out of which those reforms can come into being. But that's only going to become effective if there are people working in the middle. What it would have taken would have been people who had the ear of Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke and others, who had already written white papers, who had already thought through what the policy options would have been under the conditions of an extreme liquidity crisis. So some of us need to be thinking in those terms if these marginal experiments are going to ever be implemented, because there won't simply be a breakdown of civil order, and none of us should be revolutionaries in a way that actually advocate for that, because the first ones to have their throats cut under those circumstances are the intellectuals, the forward thinkers, we are not the people with guns in the street who are going to overpower everybody. We're the ones who are protected by civil order, and we don't want to create those kinds of breakdowns.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's
a very cool reminder. I think Terry, those kinds of violent overthrows usually the intelligentsia gets their heads handed to them first. I wanted to pick up on what you were saying about these white papers. That's what I mean. That's what I'm talking about in terms of these. Really doing the work to think through some of the things that look like they're going to happen. People are predicting another financial meltdown. There are people who are engaging with this, and to really on the left be awake to what can happen and what new choices can be made that will restructure our systems. And I think also. This is also an important place for local action, that it's not just the sort of big thinkers that are trying to think through these things at a systemic level, but also at local levels, experiments and ways of trying to create different ways of working together, and can also be, as Terry was saying, these spare parts from which the new can create.
I'll just add here, I think this is where it's also so critical that the difference between sort of I'm going to call evolutionary activism versus revolutionary activism, the kind of next steps and structures and systems that build forward and move us forward but don't necessarily highly destabilize the existing structures, don't radically, aren't so radical that they break things down, and that's where acting, politics is the art of the possible, and when I think the future left gets too far outside the art of the possible, even in heightened situations like you're talking about, Terry, the art of the possible, it's when they get into either sort of alternative systems and structures that really aren't connected to the existing system and structure and so aren't feasible, or they're connected but they're so destabilizing that they can be problematic, and there's this understandable resistance by the more conservative among the society to embrace that radical change. So I think acting within an evolutionary frame, not a revolutionary frame, is really critical.
But I add to that, I think because we're engaging. If you look at, standing in Germany, looking at what's happening in America right now, the kind of fear that seems to be. So much has become since 9/11, I think, more and more a part of the fabric of American life. It seems from a distance. Now, I don't know if that's just media or really what's quite going on right at the moment. But the at times of fear, people tend to pull back and retrench in what is most safe, what is most secure, what is who is the we that we are. And I think that's part of what the left has to have the guts to do is to be able to realize, that as we're going through these movements, that rather than a retrenchment to fear, to offer new options is, that's going to be incredibly important.
Okay. I think this is a moment to we have like 7 hands up, and I have questions online, and we have all kinds of engagement. And I'm sorry, I think we need to do a little transition here where there's going to be an opportunity a little bit later in the call to ask questions. So please keep your questions in mind, and we will come back to them. And I have the questions here written down from those who've been writing them to us as well. So thank you very much. We will come back to some of those. I think what we want to do right now is take a brief break, and then we're going to transition and do a little bit of voting on the most important issues for a future left to focus on. But before we get to the voting, Steve is going to do a brief sort of station identification and talk briefly about the Institute for Cultural Evolution and our campaign, and then we'll come back to that, to the voting.
Thank you, Carter. So, yes, this is our 2-minute non-commercial, non-profit commercial. And that is that the Institute for Cultural Evolution is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We are incorporated in 2013, and our mission is to bring the light of this evolutionary perspective to bear upon political problems. Our focus is on cultural evolution, right? I mean, we certainly want to see results at the federal and the local levels of politics. But where we feel we could have some traction is in changing public opinion and helping people think about cultural evolution from a new perspective and in a new light. And so in that way, it's a new kind of activism, and one which is not enjoying the support of the mainstream. We're definitely outside of the box, if you'll pardon the cliche, with much of what we're doing. But as Carter so poignantly said, politics is the art of the possible, so we're focused not on utopian visions, but on what can be done in terms of the adjacent possible for evolution. And in order to do that, as a small startup nonprofit, we need your help. We need you to participate. Everyone who's on this call, we very much appreciate you being here. We're going to carefully consider and reflect on everything that's been said, both in the questions that aren't being raised live here, but afterwards we're going to analyze this carefully. So you're already, everyone who's listening to me now, participating in a very important way that's supporting us tremendously. And we also invite you to participate in other ways, such as taking our polarization test and reading our papers, commenting on our website, spreading the word on social media. Those are all ways you can help us. But, of course, we're not independently wealthy. We are a nonprofit. We are very much grassroots and scrappy at this point. And so we have a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo, which went live on Wednesday. And this crowdfunding campaign is going to be going until December 3rd. We've already raised close to 40% of our goal, but the way the crowdfunding physics works is you get a big pop at the beginning because you get everybody to spread the word, and then there's typically, it's tough in the middle, and then you have a big pop at the end. So our simple request to you is if you're on this call and if you're enjoying it and you want to support our work further, if you can make an affordable contribution to our Indiegogo campaign, we'd be extremely grateful. And to get to that, just go to our website, culturalevolution.org, and you'll see a menu button that says Indiegogo campaign, and you can just follow the links directly to Indiegogo's website. And so thanks for letting me bring that up.
Okay, great. Thank you, Steve. And so we want to move on now, and we're going to experiment with a little participatory democracy on this Maestro call. And what we're going to do is we want to hear from you about the most important issues you think the future left to focus on, and I've got 5 issues that I'm going to read to you, and I'm going to have people vote on their first. We're going to vote on the most important issue that you think. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read all these. I'm going to read the 5 issues, and I want you to think about what's your number one issue among those 5, and I'm going to read them again through 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And when you hear your issue, you can vote either 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 on your phone, on your keypad. So first I'm just going to read through, so just listen to these issues and let us and think about what's your most important of these 5. So the issues are number 1, income inequality, which is obviously a very important issue to the left. It continues to be, and it's a growing issue. Number 2, federal spending and entitlement reform. Number 3, climate change. Number 4, immigration reform. And number 5, national infrastructure development. These are all five issues that are talked a lot about in the media these days and talked about a lot in both political parties. So I'm going to read these through again, and when you hear your number of the issue you feel is most important for the future left to focus on, please punch that number into your keypad, and we'll do a little experiment in voting on Maestro here and see which is the most important issue. So if income inequality, number one, is your most important issue, hit one on your keypad. If federal spending and entitlement reform is the most important issue, hit two on your keypad. If climate change is the most important issue for the future left to focus on, hit three on your keypad. If immigration reform is the most important issue for the future left to focus on, hit four on your keypad. And if national infrastructure development is the most important for the future left to focus on, hit five on your keypad. All right. We're just going to wait a second here for the votes to be tallied and for them to come up. I think it takes a second or two for them to get through the system. So there we go. Here we go. Okay, there they are. The votes are in, and this is not surprising, but with 26% of the voting, it looks like climate change is the most important for the future left. And that's not surprising. I'm not surprised by that. And so I think what we'll do is we'll go through one more time, and we're going to say your second most important issue. So if climate change was your first, you get another vote, and you can vote for another issue. You can vote for the second most important issue. Let's see what comes up this time. Okay, so let's clear all the voting. I think David, our technician, can we clear the voting there? Is that possible? Okay, voting's cleared. All right. So we're going to go through this again. So number one issue, income inequality. If that is your second most important issue, press one on your keypad. Number two, federal spending and entitlement reform. If that's your second most important issue, hit number two on your keypad. Number three, climate change. If that's your second most important issue, if it was your first most, you can't vote for it again. But if it's your second most, hit number three on your keypad, climate change. Immigration reform, number four, if that's your second most important issue. Again, you can't vote for it if it was your first, but if it's your second, hit four on your keypad. And five is national infrastructure development. If that's your second most important issue, hit number five on your keypad. And let's see where the voting is. And interesting, a close race last time. Climate change was number one, and income inequality was number two. Not entirely surprising. And this time, with 27% of the second place votes, income inequality was the most important issue for the future left to speak to. That's what the voting is. And climate change was number two. So a lot of the people who had who didn't have climate change as number one had it as number two. But interestingly enough, income inequality was first. So really, income inequality and climate change are the two most important issues, according to this call, that the future left should focus on. Interesting data, and in some ways, probably maybe what I would have was spoken to, but it's fascinating to do these kinds of tests, and we really appreciate everyone participating in this. Okay. So what we're going to do now is give you more of an opportunity to participate with each other and to speak. We're going to take 10 minutes, and we're going to, if you're on Maestro, we're going to break up into small groups if you would like to speak with other people in a small group. If not, you can just consider the question that we're going to be offering to everyone. You consider that on your own just for 10 minutes, and then we're going to come back and answer more questions and speak a little bit more before the end of the call. So if you would like to participate with others in a small group discussion of about four or five people, hit one on your keypad. If you would not like to participate in a small group discussion of four people, hit five. And while you're doing that, I'm going to read the question that we would suggest that you discuss in the group discussion, and that question is simple. It says, how would my approach to politics change
if I embrace the spirit of the future left in the way that we've been talking about it today, how would my approach to politics change if I embrace the spirit of the future left in the way we've been speaking about it on this call? So that's the question to talk about. If you'd like to be in the group, hit 1 on your keypad. If you'd like to participate in the group, if you prefer not to participate in the group, hit 5 on your keypad. For those of you who are listening on the webcast, you are welcome to consider that question on your own or with anyone you're listening with. And we will return in about 10 minutes. You have about 10 minutes to speak about. I think you'll hear a little bell, and then you will be in your groups, and you can begin to speak. So David, our technician, if you could move people into small groups, we will see everyone in 10 minutes, and we will continue a Q&A and comments at that point. Thank you very much.
You are now in a breakout. Please begin. Please bring your conversation to a close. This breakout session is now ending.
Okay, I believe we're back in... Yes, is that right, Deb? Are we back? Yes, okay. So, welcome back, everyone. I hope you had a productive discussion. And for those of you who weren't in the small groups, I hope you were able to think some about this question and think some about the various points that have been shared today about the future left. We're going to take some comments and questions now, but I wanted to say that we can't get to all the questions on this call, but if you have an interesting question or a particular question that you really would like answered, we may take some of those questions, and you're always welcome to comment on our website at culturalevolution.org. We may take some of the questions here and write blog posts, answers to them that we weren't able to get to today, so please check out our blog on culturalevolution.org, we may be able to address some of those questions there as well. All right, so if you have a question or you'd like to share something briefly about what your group spoke about, please hit 1 on your keypad. And let's see, we have a question from area code 617. If we could unmute that speaker.
Yeah, hi, do you hear me?
Yeah, great. Yes.
Great. Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is the Boston area. My name is Paul Bernstein. I had actually pressed the button before the breakout group. I wanted to respond to a lot of what Elizabeth was saying in terms of the left needing or the future left needing a pragmatic vision for the future. And in terms of economics, rather than just being anti-everything, there's two things that could be considered that have already been implemented and that are being promoted. One is, instead of companies being solely for the holders of capital, which is what capitalism means, they would be for all their stakeholders. So there's a professor at the Wharton School of Finance in Philadelphia who calls this multi-stakeholder. And it basically means having corporations, and some of them are doing it already, that have equal value in their strategy for the consumers, for the employees, for the local community, and for their suppliers, instead of all of it being for the fifth group, which is the investors. So a multi-stakeholder enterprise. It doesn't have to be called socialism. It doesn't have to scare people. It just gets to that sharing and that caring that other people and Elizabeth were speaking about. And because she's based in Germany, she sees some examples of this. There's something called middle enterprise there. I won't go into it now. But the second... thing that's very important for our future economy that gets into the spiritual and would change economic behavior is that our culture of economics not be so materialistic. By saying that people can feel successful, as Forbes magazine does, because they have more money than somebody else, is really childish. There's not even an adult personality that responds to that. And we have a whole culture which is based on people feeling, instead of intrinsic worth, instead of having a soul-based economy, in other words, we have this materialist measure of personal worth. Just 2 points to put into the future, and they're concrete.
Okay. Thank you. Elizabeth?
That's great to hear. And yes, it's interesting that I think there was a Guardian article pointing to these mid-sized family-owned, sort of very community, often very community-based corporations in Germany, that Germany has balanced something in terms of a capitalist engagement and a certain level of regulation that has provided the fuel for the economic model that it is. But I appreciate your response.
And one really important point about this is that because we churn stocks so rapidly, the shareholders are actually the group that can bail out on a corporation most readily, whereas the suppliers, the employees, the community can't. And so the enduring relationship to the long-term performance of the corporation is going to be advocated for and represented best by some of those other stakeholders, not the shareholders.
Okay. Thanks very much, Paul. I'm going to move on to another question we have online. Someone's been asking this question that came in just a little bit ago. It says, how would you speak truth? This is a question I think Terry was speaking to truth to power, the idea of the left speaking truth to power. And the question is from Colorado. How would you speak truth to power, especially when it involves so much power, when there's so much power and money on both sides of the government? You know, how do you speak truth to power in a context like that?
Well, if this is directed to me, my point of view is I don't want to speak truth to power. I want to bring power to power and not stand in this position like, oh, the power's over there and it's not over here. There's all kinds of ways for us to speak truth to power. I think that, you know, Dwayne Elgin's doing some very creative things in terms of advocating for, you know, citizens have rights over airwaves and monopoly rights over cable TV companies, and therefore there are all kinds of ways that the media can be brought under some level of, you know, obligation to serve public service goals. That's one example. I'm less interested in this pathetic kind of image of heroism where you've got the one guy in front of the tank or the courageous person who has the chutzpah to speak truth to power but then gets cut down. I think we actually have to stop getting mad and start getting even and actually make change.
Okay, so we're going to take another question from area code 978. If we could unmute that individual. You should be unmuted. Yes, please, go ahead.
Hi, this is Joe. Is this me?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. In our group, we talked a little bit about the media and social media kind of aligning itself to cause polarization nowadays. It's almost like each outlet has their own advertising, their own, you know, they're speaking to a room full of people that they know will buy certain products. And can we talk about maybe a way out of that? I mean, we would,
yes,
you know, we have to meet on social media ourselves here, right? So it's the answer, and it's also the source of much of the problem.
You know, this is a fascinating question because one of the things that we were just, as I mentioned, Steve and I were just presenting and co-hosting a conference of a lot of people involved in the issue of political polarization at Esalen a couple weeks ago, and this issue really came up a lot with this, what people were referring to as the tribalization of our culture in some sense. You know, people are living with the people who are more like them politically and socially. People are engaging with people who are more like them politically and socially. And the internet and social media and the breakthroughs in communications technology, which were often heralded in the early days of that, of those technologies, as being this, you know, the kind of freedom of global communications and to connect people with people not like themselves all over the world. And while that has been true to some degree, it's also had a slightly worrying underside, which is that it's called which has been the tribalization of our media and the tribalization of our culture, which people can easily get into kind of bubbles of tribal sort of communication bubbles where they end up only communicating with people around their side. And
And this is a real issue, and it's a very interesting development in our global culture. It's not even just an American phenomenon. Does anyone on the panel want to speak briefly to it?
Sure. I think that it's actually even difficult to not have that happen because of the way search engines and I think Facebook, for example, works in terms of keeping feeding you things that they think they know you want. So it's actually even built into the system to create that kind of tribalism. But it's interesting, and I think this is ends up being a spiritual question, I think, for humanity, for all of us, that we are all a part of much more consciously a world that is bigger than you could say in a few generations in the past, that there's so much information and there's also just so much awareness of what's happening in the world. I think the need to feel that one is a part of a group of human beings who see things the same way, I think, has become more. And this isn't happening in communities anymore. It's not happening in neighborhoods anymore. It's happening through media and social media, that you find your tribe, as you're saying. And I think that there's some way that we need to begin to really look at difference from a ground of unity. And I don't mean that even necessarily in a deep spiritual sense, but there's some way that in particularly I think from the left, that we need to create our communications that really are emphasizing that we are one human species on this planet together, because you can't really engage with difference in a way that can be productive unless you share something, and we all share being human, and there's some way that we've got to work that will be productive. And I think that there may be this is something that's going to have to get worked out probably beyond social media, but I think it's an important shift.
Let me just chime in and add to what you just said, Elizabeth, and that is that if we think about this in terms of evolution, which is a huge part of what we're trying to do with our think tank here, one of the ways evolution works, one of the ways this has been understood from the beginning, even before Darwin, was that it proceeds by a series of steps wherein there's differentiation, and then that allows for a higher level of integration. And so what we're seeing now at this time in history is a huge amount of differentiation into tribes and the compartmentalizing of the electorate and the culture through the mechanisms that the media are making possible. However, rather than thinking in terms of trying to glue the thesis and antithesis back together, if you will, or trying to lament this kind of centrism that's no longer really a possibility, we're thinking in terms of what this higher level integration could look like that still preserves a degree of the tribalism, right? We're not going to become America of the past, but we can become a new kind of American culture, American politics, that has a synthesis that allows for greater differentiation. And what that means concretely is spelled out in much of the material on our website.
Great. Thank you for that question. It's such an important issue. It really has come. Whenever you talk about political polarization, that issue comes up. So thank you for that. We have again, you can ask questions on the webcast by typing them in to the box there. You can email us at info@culturalevolution.org. We have a question here from Susan Wilcox in Brooklyn, who wants to know about the work. She works with millennials, and she knows, she says, that they have a desire. So they desire a way to navigate through this spectrum of views in perhaps a different way. She says they have a diversity of friends. They hold their relationships above their political views often. What about the generational influence? This is also an important issue when we talk about the future left and future right. Well, that future left and future right are going to be largely determined by that generation over the next, 10 to 20 years. So does anyone want to speak to the influence of millennials on the development of the future left and this issue of political polarization?
I can
chime in on that. Go ahead, Elizabeth, you first.
I think it's actually quite interesting because, and I think this is something that developmentally, it's going to be interesting to see how millennials develop in terms of the development of their consciousness, of their capacity for cognition, et cetera. Because I think right now a lot of millennials are deeply sympathetic to what have been positions from on the left. However, I think a lot of them are more libertarian in their outlook, meaning that their sense of the fact that they have friends from different nations, that they think everybody should be able to do whatever they want, to love who they want, and so forth, is based on an individualistic perspective. I think everyone should do what they want to do, and not on not coming necessarily out of a more sense of a commons, or how do we create something that works differently together. So that's one of the concerns that I have about millennials and is that they seem to be very socially liberal, and I don't know how that translates into left and right in the future.
Well, in our paper, I just could add that we do mention the millennials as, in some ways, the prototype of the future left and the future right. At least some of the position that we're advocating or trying to get people to consider in terms of what an evolution on the left and the right look like can be found in a nascent form within the millennial generation. And part of that can be explained by the fact that the baby boomers getting out of the conformist establishment that we found ourselves in the 50s. Acrimony, you know, a lot of energy and antithesis, which was evolutionarily appropriate at the time. But because much of that's been accomplished, although there's still, of course, plenty yet to be accomplished, millennials have a different set of evolutionary opportunities. And so we're hoping that our vision for the future left and the future right is something that millennials will naturally find themselves moving into.
Thank you. Thanks for that question, Susan. We're going to take a question now from area code. Let me just look here and see. Area code 808. If we can unmute that area code, you should. Yeah, you're unmuted. Yeah, please. You're live. What's the question or comment?
This is Susan. Hear me?
Oh, is this Susan Wilcox?
No, this is Susan.
Oh, okay.
This is
different
Susan.
Okay.
808 Susan.
Okay, great.
Question that came up for me when Elizabeth was talking is, what is, you know, this is kind of going from a big to maybe a small part of the picture, but what is the place as a person who stands on the left, which I do, but I'm in a family, and my husband's a conservative Republican who listens to Rush Limbaugh in the living room. What is the place of emotional response? In other words, and I think that this really came up in the public dialogue with the Sam Harris, Ben Affleck conflict that went viral. That there's just a, it seems on the left, there's just a, you know, if I have to listen to one more birther tell me that Obama's not an American citizen, I'm just going to go ballistic. Or if I have to listen to Rush Limbaugh scream and yell, I'm going to start screaming and yelling. And what Terry was talking about in terms of power to power, you know, how do you navigate bringing emotions into the arena in a way that doesn't increase the polarization or get you down a path that's just going to be a, like being in a eddy in a, you know, when you're going down a river and you're just caught there.
Well,
thanks, Susan.
You know, there are a lot of emotions and different emotions function differently. And I find that when I'm able to be with my own experience in a way that is fundamentally okay with myself, okay with life, okay with how things are,
then there's not this edge of, ain't it awful, things are screwed up and it needs to change now. This kind of anxiety, angst, uptightness, and not projecting something on the other person that distances them. The problem is the examples you gave are examples of that kind of angst. I'm so sick of hearing Rush Limbaugh. I'm so sick of hearing the birthers. I'm so sick of, you know, and at the place where you have that emotional reaction of that kind, it's hard to bring the emotions in a useful way. I think it's important to work with them in a way that you get to a place where your own relationship to that feeling is more mature. In the midst of it, it just does increase polarization. If you're feeling that kind of reaction to Rush and your husband is hyperventilating on the right, you're probably just going to fight with him. And so I would tend to think that other emotions, you know, your just sincere care for the condition of the planet or for people who are suffering in some way is probably something that will tend to reach him or reach others on the right in a much more direct way, because we have a lot of emotion, and without emotion, just trying to go into a neutral, logical exposition of our thoughts, I don't think is effective. I think it's our emotion that actually magnetizes people to our passions and to what we care about, but we've got to show up in a relationship to them that's inherently magnetic and attractive. And our reactive emotions don't accomplish that. They just increase polarization. That's why things tend to degenerate, because once we're irritated, our irritation breeds irritation, and then things just kind of degenerate into a shouting match. It makes for good TV, but it doesn't make for any kind of resolution.
Great. Thanks so much for that question. We're getting questions that really really kind of address to the heart of not just the future left, but of the nature of polarization. And I appreciate people, you know, the concerns that people are expressing and the questions they are. We have a question online, or someone sent in by email, that's also a common question, especially on the left, I think, is that this conception that corporations dominate so much of the political process, especially in America, and the lobbying and special interests seem to be so dominant in presidential politics and politics in general, and White House and Congress. So how does the panel, the person is asking, see us addressing that issue? How's the future left going to change that kind of critical issue, sort of the corporate takeover, the perceived corporate takeover of our political system?
Well, this is a persistent long-term problem that needs to be addressed in a lot of different ways, and it's fundamental. There are all kinds of people on the left trying to address it through, you know, just elect another Democratic president and have a big surge for the Democrats in 2016, and enough Supreme Court judges will die that we'll be able to overturn Citizens United, or the movement to try to create a constitutional amendment that would overthrow Citizens United, which polls show most Americans don't support. But as a pragmatic matter, nothing about that is likely to change in the next little while. So the things that we can do practically have to do with communicating about it, and people are doing a good job. You know, I'm excited by some of the there's just so many people who are pointing out that in certain respects the political system in America has become corrupt, particularly because of what is legal in terms of campaign donations and the degree to which election results can be powerfully influenced by spending. So, you know, money turns out to be speech in a way that is, undermining the fundamental tenets of a democracy. The problem with it is we're not going to make it all better, you know, and struggling in the midst of limitation is the way human beings muddle forward. So it is awful, but wringing our hands and just being frustrated about it and thinking that it should be different is part of the way that people on the left have managed to make ourselves ineffective. I think our relationship to this has to shift to one in which we realize that muddling ahead under these apparently adverse circumstances and getting out the word so that people can see this corruption and see that it can be changed, that we
point to the problem, but we point to the problem in a way that expresses a commitment to a process through which it can be ameliorated, rather than kind of a, just a hysterical, ain't it awful kind of orientation. That is the way I'm orienting.
That makes sense, Terry. I was just thinking as you're saying this that it's so easy to get caught in the idealism, cynicism trap, you know, where you maybe have overly idealistic, maybe aspirational and authentic feelings about how things could be, but they aren't maybe realistic to what's possible, really. And then we get sort of trapped in the, on one hand being idealistic, and the other hand falling into a certain kind of cynicism about, it's not going to change anyway. When actually, as you say, things kind of muddle forward. And one of the things we've spoken about in terms of this political polarization, it's not, if this was easy to change, this hyper-polarized situation we find ourselves in, if this was easy to change, it would have changed a few years ago, or when Obama got elected, or before, or when it just, this is 20, 30, 40 years in the making, and it's going to be at least a decade, if not more, to work ourselves into a different kind of political situation. But what we can do now is put into place so that the next 10 years we can work so that the following 10 years are actually a lot better. And that's real activism, and that's the kind of impact we can have. We're getting to the end of the call here, and I think we'll take maybe one more question before we take final comments from our panel. There's a question from area code 541. You'll be unmuted here in about half a second. And
hi, this is Dexter from Eugene, Oregon.
Yes.
Hi, Dexter.
Hi, Dexter.
I was really moved by what Terry said about speaking from a position of power rather than sort of whining and you know, fighting against and being overcome by this adversary. We need to find a power in ourselves that is greater than the evil we're confronting. And, of course, that power has to be spiritual. We can't be delusional and say, oh, we have worldly power, you know, we have money, we have, the system doesn't serve us. We have to sort of get our power from a different place. And that's really the basic condition of the world from the beginning, is we're confronted with this material power which is antithetical to the spiritual truth that we all love and want to operate from. And so we're torn between, you know, this truth that is so real, but yet we're faced with daunting, you know, obstacles, you know, physical powers and evil, so to speak. And so it's really a deeper level, I think, that somehow something has to change in how we confront our political problems.
Hear, hear. Thank you, Dexter.
Thanks, Dexter. If there's no other comments from that on that, I think I'll move into maybe one last comment we may have time for before we close the call. We have still have a few hands up, and there's a call from area code 518. Perhaps we could take that. Should be unmuted now. Area code 518.
Oh, I was muted, Carter. Sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Okay. Yeah, we can hear you.
Perfect. Great. I actually want to follow up a bit with, I think it was the first comment or question after our group breakout. I'm not sure if the individual was in my group or not, but if he wasn't, our group was also focused a bit on how the media fragmentation over time has sort of led to where we are now, or a symptom of where we are now. And it really got me thinking when you and others were responding in terms of the work and awareness that you were mentioning in the other conferences that you have been about, sort of the core issue of polarization and maybe being a piece of it, is, you know, what came to mind was that would be interesting, since I'm sure many of us that are here listening are evolutionaries, and obviously it's an evolutionary approach that is core to your...
I'm having just a little bit of trouble. Either you're maybe too close to your microphone.
If I go off hands-free, any better now?
That's better. That's better, yeah.
Perfect. Sorry about that. So should I want rewind a little bit? Or
yeah, just rewind maybe just briefly, yeah.
Gotcha, sure. So in terms of the social media and the fragmentation that goes on and the bubbles that we all live in that helps sort of create the polarization that was talked about too in the group that we broke out on. And sort of one thing that came to mind, being an evolutionary organization that you're focusing on what's the next level of evolution for politics, specifically today with the left. What's the possibility from an almost incubator standpoint of getting different factions of the left or folks on the left on right to experiment on how to evolve beyond the fracturization from a emotion or responsive standpoint to see how to talk values and come to some common ground, even though politically they come from different points of view.
I can respond to that a little bit and just say that part of the way we can get people to move, part of the method that we're developing for evolving consciousness is by focusing on existential problems that people can't solve. And one of the existential problems that the left has is it's relatively politically impotent. And one of the ways that it can evolve in ways that it can make it more effective at a national level and in the issues that it cares about is to envision a more unified form of left. That's kind of what led to our campaign for envisioning, defining, developing, and making visible in the culture a vision of a more evolved left, which is kind of what we've been about today.
And one of the things that you say in the paper, Steve, that you didn't point out, you did point out earlier, but that I want to point out right here and now, is you also basically say that the place of leadership is with the postmodern left, that for us to become more optimistic and less reactive can begin to unlock the gridlock and the polarization stasis. And
yes, absolutely.
So that sense that we have a responsibility, that those of us on the call who are contemplating these things are in a position of cultural leverage, is an inspiring vision, and it calls upon what's most healthy and heroic and positive and creative in all of us to sense that maybe we're in a position to pivot and shift, and by coming together and advancing these kind of discourses, we might begin to, in a sense, maybe we are prototyping some, this move that can leverage the whole system out of its current stuckness.
Fantastic. That's great, Tara. I think that's a great place to end the call today, and I just want to thank our panel for being part of it. Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you, Steve. And I want to thank all the wonderful questions from everyone. Those are great questions. It was a good discussion. We really appreciate everyone's participation. We invite you to come to ask any questions that come to your mind or comments as you consider these things, as you think about them, as you contemplate them. Please feel free to email us or come to our website and comment. We are going to be planning a call for the future right, similar to this in some ways, and we'll be letting you know about that, where we'll be exploring things from a completely different point of view, but really trying to approach the same issue of political polarization. And we invite you to participate in our campaign in multiple ways. Come take our polarization test. Come, share or comment or engage with us on social media, and you're more than certainly welcome to contribute to our crowdfunding campaign or participate in it in any way. So thank you all for your support.